almost everybody that takes a job in IT audit, they're like, dude, I don't really know how to explain my job to anybody.
Still can't explain my job to my mom. She like is always asking what I do. And I'm like, just tell her, I like, tell your friends that I work at a security startup. Just leave it as that. Before it was a lot harder. I would like actually try to explain it to like my girlfriend or my mom or even my friends. And they'd be like, yeah, for sure, dude. Well, glad you're crushing it. No idea what you're talking about.
Nor do I want to know. Yeah. Hey, what is up, everybody? I'm Kenny Scott. I'm the host of the Paramify podcast. We love GRC nerds, and we found a cool one. Today's guest is Jack Rumsey, head of GRC at Swimlane. What are you going to learn about today?
Never thought
head of GRC.
That would be my title in life, GRC nerd. I don't know how.
Dude, it's what you aspired to subconsciously. Yeah. You know, man, every day you're like just putting the headband on and you're like, how do I be a better auditor, man? You go, let's go. He's also, right? So Jack, also you're an Oscal aficionado, right? And yes. So there's not a lot of those, man. Yeah. You got a rich background in IT, security, and audit. You had roles at DaVita, Shellman, who I call like the Yankees of the, you know, the federal government audit space, right? KPMG also, right? So we share like, yep, we got our same scars, right? You're an expert. So Jack's an expert in compliance standards, SOC 2, ISO 27001, GDPR, FedRAMP. He's you know, went to school at Illinois State, where you did information system security, computer information system security.
That's where it all began. That's how I got roped into this career. I don't know by choice or not, but State Farm is headquartered where I went to school. And I was in a mentorship program with this really cool dude named Eric. And he pretty much was like, yo, there's this career within security, and it's called IT audit. And I think the talent gap, I mean, 7 years ago, they're looking for fresh heads to come in. So relatively easy to get that job. And I go into the first day of that, and they're in the old State Farm building that was built in like the 1800s. And I'm like, what the hell did I sign up for? and I was auditing control.
Dude, we're like kindred spirits, man. Keep going, dude. This is good.
I started there. It was a sick job though, because like the salary was tight, and I was like, wow, there's a little bit of imposter syndrome right out of school. Like, dude, I'm like doing this thing, have no idea what I'm doing. But as I guess I progressed and I realized that no one really knows what they're doing well in this space until you get in.
Yes, dude. Oh my gosh. So you had the same thing as me. It's that job, you know, I've made a terrible mistake, right? Arrested Development, right? The same, that gif is like almost everybody that takes a job in IT audit. They're like, dude, I don't really know how to explain my job to anybody.
Still can't explain my job to my mom. She like is always asking what I do. And I'm like, just tell her, tell your friends that I work at a security startup. Just leave it as that. Before it was a lot harder. I would like actually try to explain it to like my girlfriend or my mom or even my friends. And they'd be like, yeah, for sure, dude. Well, glad you're crushing it. No idea what you're talking about.
Nor do I want to know. Yes.
It goes from days being entitled, like I'm learning so much about the company. Like I'm under all these rocks. And then other days I'm like, my job is completely pointless. Like we're not doing anything out there. And so, you know, it's been a long journey, but luckily, you know, there's been times in that journey where I was like, maybe I should just scrap it. But luckily, landed on my feet. And I think once you just get the experience of IT audit, You can do a lot with it if you are creative. If you're not creative, then you just have to stay in IT audit and be fine with that or scrap it.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, dude. You're amazing. Oh, my gosh, dude. Well, I got my – me and Jack don't really know each other yet, but I already know we're going to do this again. So this is awesome, man. So you got into – you know, cyber is a big area, right? So, like, when you think of cyber in general, McKinsey says it's like a $2 trillion market, right? And then in there, you know, in that space, GRC software is easily a $100 billion market, like GRC software in particular. So you've got adjacent areas with security automation, compliance management. And so there's, if you're, like you said, if you're creative and if you understand genre, if you understand, if you're a domain expert, you know, you got a lot of problems to solve and it's just so awesome. So I'm excited to learn more about what you guys are doing in Swimlane, but you know, it's just great, right? I just want to like to talk about that. Usually we say like at the end, like how people need to get into a, you know, the IT, you know, security space, because it's a huge field. It's a huge opportunity. A lot of our wars are going to be, you know, cyber wars. There's already a super crazy element of that. I have a friend in who works for the, you know, cyber warfare division in the Air Force, and his job's awesome, right? It's so cool, but it's already happening, all this security stuff. And so it's just so freaking important. And if you go into IT audit, you know, you really set yourself up for a great career because you're a generalist and it's okay that you don't know anything, right? Like you go in and you're like, they just like convinced people, you know, via like really, you know, lunches, you know, if you go work for the Big Four, you know, they wine and dine you and you're like, oh man, this is great. And you get to work at like awesome companies and you're like, oh, this is great. And I get to work with management, but you don't really actually focus on what am I actually going to do? And no one really knows until you just go through those busy seasons, right? You know, supporting audit and all that stuff. And then you're like, oh, now I get it, you know, but it takes a while, right? I don't know.
Yeah. And at KPMG, so I got that post college. So that was my second job out of college, but they throw you into the wolves. I think in any team you're at in the Big Four, you know, your first day is like they throw you audit work and they say, look at last year's file. And they have you doing kind of like, you know, the grunt work to begin with, but it really does. And I guess IT audit, it made me learn quick. It made me learn quick. I would say, the internal audit it's a little vague, like when I was doing it for a company, because you can kind of make up your own scopes and you may or may not even be following a framework. But when you get into the Big Four and then, you know, you start writing SOC 2 reports at Shellman, then that's when you kind of become the SME that's required to be in a leadership position handling compliance or GRC. But yeah, they throw you to the wall.
Right.
I don't know. It was a good experience overall.
Yeah, like the best experience to never have again, right?
Right.
Yeah, man. Yeah, you just like you do learn so quick, and you when you say the wolves, like I mean, someone coming out of college, you know, you've never really done anything. You've never done a deployment before. You've never seen, you know, anything when it comes to IT, but you go. And you do this walkthrough and you just become a professional interviewer, right?
Yeah,
like a business intelligence professional interviewer. And you learn how people do their jobs and you do that over time and you start to learn a lot. And you also learn a lot about what can go wrong in terms of design. And so when you have that like process, like, and you are creative, it allows you, like you said, there's just so much room for innovation in this area. Right. So last week you sent me a video on your NIST destroyer solution. It looked pretty interesting. Can you?
Yeah, definitely. That may not be the official name. That's not baked into the product yet. So that vision, we actually won an internal hackathon that Swimlane put on. So we do an internal hackathon every year at Swimlane. That's offered to the whole company. Usually GRC isn't really the team that's submitting ideas for this, because I mean, we've got like professional services people that spin up like automation use cases for our customers. So they're in the tool every day. They know how to, you know, build out playbooks and do cool stuff in it. So it's really for them, but you know, the hackathon's open for anyone in the company. And since I get the question, you know, as like the GRC head here, from customers and prospects, like how does this thing track compliance? Like we're going to spin this product Swimlane up in our SOC, and it's going to help with these cool use cases. But how do we track that against like our compliance frameworks? And the answer was always very vague. Like, well, yeah, I mean, the stuff you're doing in the product is definitely going to help you satisfy controls for whatever framework that is under scope for you guys. But there's no way, like, we're not telling you what the product does to satisfy that. You have to almost have a compliance expert in that tool to map, right, or to even define, you know, cherry pick evidence, whether that's screenshots or however you want to do it. But that's where the gap is like the customers we sell to, we're selling to a SOC, we're selling to like a security team, and there may or may not even be like a GRC user that's in that tool. Or coming from a large company, you know, once you get big enough, these teams get really siloed, and your GRC people could potentially not even know a tool like this even exists, or that they can even like leverage a tool like this to get evidence for audit. So I think one way to solve that was our NIST Destroyer project. And it was cool for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm going to be working with product this quarter to try to flesh out this idea and, you know, make it viable, at least as like a little add-on that you can have in our product. But
sweet,
solving two things. One thing is, you know, I guess we could say we're SMEs of OScale, just since it's so new. I don't see a lot of people actually using like,
yeah,
programmatic compliance right now. And so OScale allows you to, you know, take this giant catalog. And we started with the Goliath of them. We started with NIST because that's the one that's easily available out on the web. Yeah. So we start by taking this giant JSON blob of code, and they, you know, they've tagged the different things you need in the catalog, like with different variables. And we just, my boss, who's the CISO of our company, Mike Lyborg, and another one on my team, Kevin, mm-hmm, pretty much just used Python to scrape out the things we needed in this giant JSON blob. And then we mapped those variables to our product, which is like, without getting too in the weeds, our product really allows you to automate anything. But what it does first and foremost is creates application records that you can put anything you want in an application record. You could almost, it looks like a case. It looks like a, you know, it could like a case management system. So what we did,
sure,
was we put all those variables from OScale, like, you know, starting with the obvious, the control and the control description. And those are now each their own application record. So we essentially used OScale to make a control catalog. And, you know, there's other products that obviously have this. I mean, any compliance management solution is going to have, like, you know, frameworks where you can drill into each control. And that's where you would, like, house your evidence. You know, it's just a... So we did that pretty much.
Sure.
You just kind of created like a dummy version, but for NIST. So, I mean, it's very robust. It wasn't just like we didn't start at like ISO or something very specific. We started kind of the overarching NIST framework to make each control its own application record. So you click into a control and now you're able to do whatever you want. And so the goal of that was, once we have this catalog, that's kind of our handy guide for the customers. And then the customers have a bunch of playbooks or use cases that a lot of them are soccer related. Like, that's Mike saying goodbye. I'm in the office right now.
Hi, Mike.
But like, threat hunting. That's a huge thing we do for our customers. That's like the intro use case. So it's like, all right, you got this threat hunting playbook. Here's a configuration. Now you can tie that to all of the applicable controls in NIST that playbook helps, I guess, prove out. And so you can see the configuration. That's kind of like the design of the control. And then what that playbook spits out is going to be like individual cases of like every time you've gotten an alert or done some threat hunting and how the analyst closed it. So that's all baked into our product too. And that's kind of like your test of effectiveness. So now you're able to, like in our product, the stuff you do in it are just kind of auto tied to a control. Now, the hard part is you still need a GRC person. You still need either us or somebody who knows about compliance to do that tying of evidence. But now it exists and it all exists in our system. It's not like you have to take out screenshots and then map it. You know, you can kind of quantify it now in Swimlane.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So you want to look for ways to, a lot of people want to abdicate the whole entire security problem to a robot or to a consultant or whatever it is, because it's really hard to do. I think we're still not there, right? Where you get, you know, automated security, right? You still need people that know what they're doing to architect things, and tools are really helpful and they can make things, you know, 90% more efficient, right? They can make it way, you can have quantum leaps in efficiency with tools these days, especially with great innovations like OSCAL, which allow you to programmatically read things and report on things consistently. You know, that's really great. But at the same time, people are so important for running your security program. And so you're the head of GRC now at Swimlane, and it's so cool that you're getting involved in product and you're using your tool to build GRC.
Right.
So what are your primary responsibilities right now at GRC? Like when you talk to Mike, your CISO, like what is he wanting you to accomplish? What are you trying to do there?
Yeah, so it is a meta role, just given the company, to be like handling our GRC program. So first and foremost, like I am just a compliance dude at the company. Like my black and white goals are getting us through a SOC 2, getting us ISO certified. Mm-hmm. And like that's just, that always is going to fall on me. Another thing that has... not really by design, but has fallen on me is it's a bit of a customer facing role in that, like, I am that person that's in charge of doing the security due diligence for our customers, right? So when, you know, third party risk management stuff, answering questionnaires, because we're still a small company. I handle it, like a lot of the core GRC elements at the company. But one of the reasons I took this job is for the promise that, like, we have a product that we want to make into a GRC product, and pretty much it's an automation platform. So all of our tools that we use for GRC, we can create playbooks and like start to automate GRC controls. And Mike pretty much presented to me over a couple of beers when we met about a year and a half ago. He's like, you got to get us through the audits. You're kind of like a subject matter expert at doing that, and we need help with that. We need help, you know, getting client or customers to the finish line, right, with security due diligence. So I need you to first and foremost do that stuff. Secondly, you know, as we build our team, as we build our company, you know, there's an internal audit role there, just kind of a process wise, like making sure we actually have internal controls, not just getting the check mark that we got a SOC 2. I mean, that can be done relatively easy, but building out your controls is another, you know, big aspect of the job. Thirdly, and this is now where it gets exciting, is using our product, which we use right now as our internal SOC, building out of the SOC use cases. So that's now bringing in kind of my responsibilities as GRC. So just to name one example, so you can kind of follow where I'm going with this, is our third-party risk management program. Like we use a tool called Wistic to track our vendors, track like risk for our vendors. So and that's where an easy place to start. We'll use their API, plug that into our tool, so we can then do more and see more with that data, instead of like having our whole security team have licenses to that and they don't really know what they're doing. I'm the one kind of like updating vendors and making sure we certain ones get, you know, risk assessed on an annual basis. Now we just, you know, inject that into essentially our SOC, effectively our SOC. And now my CISO can see like where our posture at is at with risk, because we've built dashboards with that data. So our tool's really good at like dashboarding stuff. And I think that that's really helpful in the GRC space, is just getting everything, that all these control families I'm looking at for audits, somehow getting that quantifiable into like a nice management dashboard. That's sort of where we're starting with like building, I guess, GRC into our program internally using Swimlin.
You know, when you're building out your GRC tools, I like what you mentioned. I mean, it's kind of subtle. You talked about like how Mike was talking to you about the job and he was discussing over beers, right? You know, what you were going to be doing. Ultimately, GRC is about relationships, because ultimately people are it, right? People, when it comes to security and risk management, decision making, it's people. You need great people. And so how do your skills in like an IT audit, how do you get feedback from folks, right? Customers on what you're building? How do you quickly get that and incorporate it into, you know, the tool that you're building with product? Tell us a little bit about that. And have you made any mistakes there? Like, because it was a new area for me, you know, being going in a cost center and then getting into product. I mean, there's a lot to learn. So what are some of the things you've done well? What are some mistakes you've made, you know?
Yeah. So at the moment, I'm not fully on the product team. So I'm not getting, you know, customer feedback per se on like, yo, this compliance tracker thing doesn't do what we want. It's not to that level yet. But I guess growing up, if you will, with that IT audit background, you know, that whole concept of being thrown to the wolves, you hit on this too. Like, you become an expert at pretty much interviewing and having humility to ask stupid questions to like figure out right. What's going on. So I guess like the relationship building happens first internally, because like, again, first and foremost, my goal is to audit the company and like know our engineering and infrastructure departments and have relationships with product for product security. And a lot of that is like, I always liked that aspect of IT audit when I was like kind of asking dumb questions, but like with a little smile on my face, like, explain this to me. Like, let's like just talk like normal people. I'm not trying to flex on you. I'm not trying to even act like I know your tech. I just need you to explain it to me as like an auditor. But what I hated about that was like that questioning process when you're like an external IT auditor, you're kind of like, well, have you ever considered this, or what are you doing for this? And then you're kind of like then switching hats and starting to roast people. And then they kind of are like, who's this guy? But like when you're doing it internally, especially for like a company that wants to build an awesome product, that is not the same relationship. They're genuinely like telling you, you know, the problems we're having and looking to you to help kind of solve and like hit it from like a, you know, a compliance lens. So like, first and foremost, we've got great, like me and the security, I'm on the security team. But our team has great relationships with engineering, and we're like sometimes assholes about stuff like controls that they need. But like more importantly, we're kind of like a voice of reason, and we're heavily involved in like product development and engineering. So those relationships are cool. The other relationships that I have right now are with customers, but it has nothing to necessarily do with the product. It's literally just our compliance posture and trying to get us through that kind of third-party risk management. And that's cool too, because now I'm like, before you're just sort of a number at these big companies, but like when you kind of run the program, you've got that, like, I guess you've got that level of authority where if a customer wants to talk to me about whatever we're doing or they have questions, I'm like, I'll fill out your questionnaire. We've got a robust trust center. I kind of like, you know, I hate filling out questionnaires, but I'll be like, yo, why don't I hop on the phone with you instead? Like, let's just like talk through this. I'm going to talk to you like a normal person. I'm not going to try to like gatekeep anything. I'm going to tell you exactly where we're at as a company. We're still a startup. And so a lot of times, like, those relationships with customers are just pretty much on the compliance side. And I'm really transparent. I think transparency is key because it shows, like, I think just my tone of voice and what I'm telling customers shows more trust than, you know, me filling out a questionnaire with like these robotic answers. I'm always welcoming conversations and like talking with customers or a lot of times prospects, risk departments, and just telling it like it is.
Yeah. What are the dangers if you're going on the flip side of that, if you're opaque, right? Like what are some of the things that happen? You know,
I would say being a little closed off or not willing to work with them. Is that what you, I mean, that's just gonna,
yeah, sure. Like if you're transparent, you're enabling trust, right? You're saying like, yeah, we're not perfect and we don't do that thing. No, that's not how we do it. And, you know, what happens when you're just like, oh, if you're guessing at like, oh, I better not tell them that. I better not tell them that. I better not tell them anything. It just, what happens there? Like, what are the outcomes typically?
Well, if you're just trying to,
if you don't do it,
I mean, like when I have these conversations, it's usually well received. But when I'm like filling out hundreds of questionnaire questions and like being more vague, because we just got to get through it. I mean, those things just add a ton of time onto my workload, just having to go back and forth between clarifications and stuff. So that's usually where I introduce a call. I mean, you can't tell like everyone everything. And a lot of times in, I guess, third party risk management, those things aren't even asked because they're sort of asked based on these industry questionnaires. And a lot of times it's like, we have this custom questionnaire, but really it's like, I've answered this a million times, so I'm going to give you the answer you need. But if you really give a shit and you want to talk like under the hood, we'll get engineering on the call. We'll get our CISO on the call. So like we just work with our customers because, I mean, I've only been here for about 2 years, but Swimlane's been around for a while. And like, we really just, given the nature of the tool, we've had customers that are super security forward, I guess. I mean, that's just the nature of our tool. So we've always kind of been in that role where we're a small shop and we're willing to work with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're doing questionnaires, right? Which is everything. You're using, you mentioned earlier that you guys use tools, right, to help you organize your SOC 2,
right.
ISO 27001, things like that. What are the key strategies for you for being effective? You mentioned you can go through and you can get a sticker or you can get a SOC 2. Anybody can kind of get that. That's easily done. But what you're interested in is building actual security. So what are some of your key strategies to leveraging compliance frameworks to help you achieve that outcome?
Yeah. And this might get into what you're doing as well, because I listened to your talk, I forget where you were talking, but it was in Vegas and you did like this whole kind of, you know, spiel about what Paramify does. And it's really similar to how I think about compliance management today. And I didn't always think about it like this, but it really comes at abstracting requirements and not just trying to follow like a line down a framework, but abstracting tools that do multiple things and kind of having them as elements that you can plug and play, and then abstracting requirements of controls. Because, you know, given that there's so many frameworks, there's a lot of repeat work, but it might not be one-to-one control language, but the requirements, the actual evidence to prove that control out, what you're doing to like satisfy control, that is like a requirement. And I think about those a lot. Those are the building blocks, I guess, security. And then you plug and play into your compliance framework. So, you know, I use a tool like called anecdotes right now. And they think about it in a very similar way. It's like framework agnostic, but like you're mapping evidence to requirements, and those requirements are like building blocks to create, you know, whatever framework you want to, I guess, prove out. So like one requirement is going to satisfy multiple controls in different frameworks, but you're really focused on what is it in this requirement that's important. And so I like the building blocks. I think that makes, I guess, the whole program easier to understand. And like that makes even writing policies and procedures easier to understand. I'm doing something right now where I'm taking a bunch of kind of like old school style written policies that we had. I mean, they do their job, but they suck, and like no one's going to read them anyway. And instead of having something like that, which will get you through compliance, it will get you through audits, breaking out our policies into, you know, control families that say, all right, our high level policy for, I mean, something easy like vendor risk management, we have like 10 activities that we do that are baked into like a policy, right? Those 10 activities then have some procedure documentation. So it's like, we'll do an annual risk assessment for our high risk third party vendors. That's got a little excerpt. So then I'll kind of have a narrative about what we do specifically for that. So it keeps everything really organized. And so I think about everything, whether it's stuff we put on the trust center, how we write our policies, how we actually like take evidence to be used in an audit. It's all tied back to stripping it away from a framework and putting it at the requirement level. And then also kind of highlighting the tools we use and plugging and playing.
Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned third party assurance. So high risk vendors. Give us an example. What to you guys is a high risk vendor? You know, what would tick that box for you? And how would you know from a policy perspective, you know, whether, you know, someone looking at a policy, oh yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. Maybe we can go into that.
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, I mean, high risk vendors are going to be different for every company, but for us, it's 100% AWS. Like that's where we host the product. I mean, it's very, very mission critical. Something that's less obvious is Bitwarden, which is just our password management tool. Like that's high risk to me. I know we really just try to like think about this. We just think about this stuff logically, like what's going to suck if it gets breached or down. And so we just talk as a team and we do it that way because we don't have a ton of customer data, right? Like it's not like we're B2C where we've got hundreds and thousands of per PII data coming into our systems. It's, you know, we're a SaaS tool that caters to security teams. So, I mean, like MongoDB is obviously a high risk vendor. It's like our infrastructure vendors that we're really concerned about. And then a couple of other ones would be like, you know, just Google, because that's our internal, you know, network that like we do everything on Google. So we got to make sure that's down. But yeah, a lot of this stuff, like risk stuff, is I love doing it here because we don't have a team of like 30 people that they don't have any other responsibility other than to think about risk. And then it creates all of these mundane processes and stuff. I mean, like risk rating vendors and attaching a score to them, that's still a good process. Like, that's fine. But like just honestly talking through some of this stuff with the right stakeholders gets you there really quickly and effectively.
Yeah. So from a policy perspective, you know, if someone's like, if someone says, "Hey, Jack, explain to me like why do we need to do this?" Right? Is there a policy statement that you would point to that says this is why we need to do it, or just the policy just says this is what we have to do? And you tell me a little bit about that. Right? Policies are kind of whack, right? I think a lot of times no one reads them. Right? I just want them to say, "What do I have to do?" Right. And whoever needs to know, this is what you have to do. Right. But
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say that there's some policies that if someone asks, why do we need this? I'll be like, because we have to get through these audits. Like, that's why we need this document. But yeah, on a more valuable level, it's like, I want the policies, because like you said, no one really like reads policies internally. So it's not necessarily for that reason. Like, there could be guides that maybe people read, but from a policy level, I want those policies to be the source of truth for everything we do. And so this also goes into my other hat, which is like dealing with our trust center and getting deals through the table and just knowing that like you got to have your ducks in line to answer these questionnaires and to create a public facing image that's really organized. So that's why I'm including everything, like what I've done from the policy level, because I think this framework's really good for it, is just like the CSA common controls matrix. It matters almost one-to-one with NIST. And, you know, NIST is just like this crazy detailed framework that it would be really hard to shape like a SaaS startup, you know, security program against. But the CSA is a little bit easier to read, and it also maps to NIST very nicely. Like it maps almost one-to-one. There's like two controls that are different. NIST is going to have more information, but CSA is kind of like this nice all-around framework that I really like. It's more robust than like just following along with like, you know, SOC 2 is so vague. So like you would never try to model your program after like AI CPA trust criteria. I mean, a lot of this stuff is just going to by default satisfy that. And then ISO is just, I don't know if you've ever done an ISO 27001 audit.
Yep.
Like
many.
Their controls are fine, but that's kind of a black box of documentation in itself that they want you to be really, really like specific about, you know, how you're like stating things. And I almost just am like, that's its own separate lane of documentation, and that the controls are common. Like, you know, when they get down to auditing the controls for that, it's going to map to these other ones, but like the specific documentation for something like ISO is kind of in its own silo. And that I would be like, we have this policy because we're ISO certified and we need, you know, to explain what the roles and responsibilities of X, Y, and Z are for this one requirement. Now, like, yeah, I guess, I don't know if I'm
answering the question. I mean, like, no, you totally are, right? So policy, what I hear is that, okay, when you're thinking of policy, think first of the framework. So what are my customers going to care about, right? So you can have policy be, we just care a lot about our customer data, right? You know, and so we're going to do the right thing. And so maybe the policy is that you say, I'm going to use NIST or I'm going to use CSA, but I like that. Don't reinvent the wheel. You know, there's a lot of smart people that have thought through cyber risk, and you're not going to really enumerate something that hasn't been seen before. So I like the idea of just picking a framework that meets your customers' requirements or your stakeholders, whoever it is, framework, and then it's policy from there. And so I think that's really, really good advice, right? Just use a framework. Don't reinvent the wheel. Start with what you have to do. And, you know, I think that's a really good idea. The other thing about like common controls, you do often need some sort of expert that understands the context of, you know, the control. CSA is great because it's got, you know, all of the, you know, implementation guidance, whereas like the other things that you mentioned, SOC 2 and ISO, they can be really vague. And it's like, you know, that the requirement is like, hey, you're going to control access, you know. You know, and that's just not very helpful, right, to an engineer, right?
Right.
And important in policy is to be very specific. Go ahead.
Yeah. Luckily, like our compliance, the tool that I leverage right now, Anecdotes, has a lot of these concepts already dialed in. So like I'm tracking like 7 frameworks, even though we're not going to even be audited to 7 frameworks. We're going to get the ISO, SOC 2, but I'll even throw in like some some Sarbanes, like ITGCs, just to make sure, you know, yeah, we got some awareness there. We're not even a public company, but like, you know, just tag it on, because what they're doing is mapping it from those requirement levels to their respective thing. So can I share my screen for a second? Sure. I don't know if it does. It should work. It should work. Yeah, sure. Let me show you, and we can stop talking about policies, because I don't know who the hell
is. Yeah, nobody really cares.
With policies.
You never know. You never know.
Being the self-described GRC nerd that I am, this shit actually does matter to me, because it's about organization and like kind of a visual representation. So, you know, we used to have, I guess, and we still do. I mean, we're kind of approving these right now, but like, you know, like a data disposal policy, a data lifecycle policy, all these things, right? Instead, what I want the high level policy to be, it's actually coming right from all of the CSA controls. So like what I'm saying from the highest level up is, these are our commitments when it comes to data security and privacy lifecycle. It's very easy to read. It's like a checklist. And so when we go to approve these, you know, we talk with the right teams and we say like, what do we got for secure data disposal? What do we got for data classification? Like, we do have a data classification policy, but it was baked into this big thing that no one's going to read. And so instead of doing that, I'm kind of creating like a requirement framework as our high level policy. And then we drill into these controls. We drill in. And so there might be now just a paragraph or like a table that actually has a relevant information to satisfy each of these requirements. So it's, in a way, it could be more documentation, but in several other ways, it's actually way more helpful to have everything be granular. So again, we can plug and play. Now, like when somebody asks on a questionnaire, what we're doing about data subject rights, I can have our DSAR kind of process, like what we do to say like, we'll delete your info or whatever, how we handle that. That's kind of mapped under this high level policy. And there's just only the information you need to tell. And it's very like low level. Like it's not abstracted at that point. It's like what I'm putting there could go directly into like an audit narrative, or that could go directly into explaining what I need to support that with audit evidence. And
totally.
It works really well in like a trust center format, because what they're trying to do is get coverage of like your whole program. And so if you can have like little excerpts for each of these things in like a public facing trust center, just a couple sentences, like, we've thought about all of these things. We don't just have one policy that might hit on three of these things, but it's like, you know, seven paragraphs long and you're not going to read it. It's more concise. And so what we're doing here, and eventually this will go into kind of like, what we're doing in the product, but it's just about mapping it. That's really all it is. It's mapping requirements.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a ton of sense, man. I love it. Don't start, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. Use a great policy framework like CSA. If it makes sense and your customers require it, like for sure on our side, it's NIST, right? Or it's, you know, CMMC, whatever it is, right? Something that gives like specific requirements on what, you know, what expectations you're meeting. And then, yeah, like even if it is a lot of documentation, you don't have to do all that manually, right? There are automation tools now, right, that can help you really streamline all of it. And then it gets whoever needs to know, it gets them the information they need to know like succinctly. So we're living in a much better time than 20 years ago, man, when we're just all Excel sheets and it's just like, So
bad. I think we're going to start living in a really good time. Like we're right on the cutting edge of making this a lot easier. So what I know you guys do is you're using OSCAL for the system security plan for FedRAMP. Now, we're not
one of the things. Yeah, one of the things we do. Yep.
It's on our roadmap, though. And so I've done a shit ton of research about what it takes. And there's a thing called advisory work. When you're a one-man compliance department, you'll have FedRAMP advisors being like, there's no way you're going to be able to do this yourself. It's too much documentation. So pay us $130,000 and we're going to help you make this SSP. And so, like, you know, the NIST Destroyer project we did, this was not going into SSP at all. So, you know, we don't actually know how to do it yet, but I'm like, wait, we can actually make this ourselves with OSCAL now. Like, we have the programming knowledge to bring this in and then just say, like, what are the requirements? And it's all, like, lined up right there. And so I know that's what you guys do.
That's right.
It's crazy. I mean, I still think it's, like, FedRAMP's just a really high goal to achieve. Like, there's so many costs related to it. I mean, there's a lot of costs related to the ongoing, like, maintenance of it as well. But, like, from
for sure,
getting quoted $130K to have some expert, and they are experts, but, like, to have them pretty much do this mundane documentation work, it's a high price to pay for literally just, like, getting information that you already have into the right format.
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree. When I started it, it was for us, for Paramify, that was easily more. And so if you're like you guys are not a super small company, but you're not super complex, right? At complex companies, we're pushing seven figures sometimes, right? To deliver that. And that's just, it is hard work, right? And it does require a lot of knowledge, but ultimately, you don't do 827 different things at your company. You have a set of tools and capabilities that literally map to all those 827 things, right? So if you think in terms of capability, that's how we do it, you know, what are you doing for multi-factor authentication? What are you doing for single sign-on? I mean, single sign-on, that's going to show up, you know, 59 times in your OSCAL SSP, right? That the component that you're using to enable single sign-on, it's going to show up 59 times. But then you have your CRM, and then you have your CRM, you have your procedures, right? And how those map to policy. And you have appendices A through R, right? That could be affected by different components, you know? And so we're totally focused on eliminating the paper chase. And we're excited to be working with, we'll be working with cool tools like you guys, right? To, you know, to solve the problem holistically, right? So when you think of risk management, a lot of tools go straight into, like, assessment, right? So there's risk management is planning, it's assessment, and it's reporting. And so we're trying to kind of go right in between those and really try to make everybody think, you know, full stop about how do I plan, how do I assess, and how do I report? And I need to think of all of those phases all together. And so it's not going to be just a magic button that says, oh, yeah, I'm done. It's going to be a little bit more involved than that. But yeah, man, Jack, we're solving it, right? And so I love talking to creatives in the GRC space. We know who you guys are. Jack and I understand you. You took the job because you're like, it seems like a good job, right? I'll do it. And then you're like, the first day, you're like, what did I do? And the people who are successful, for me, it wasn't until, you know, when I was talking to my wife, I'm like, I don't want to go to work tomorrow. She's like, what do you not like about it? I'm like, kind of everything. I kind of ate all of it, right? And then but when you start to lean into those things that hurt you, you know, and find out, hey, can I solve this problem? Then all of a sudden you have an awesome career. You're just like, whoa, dude, this is a bomb career.
There's so much room for improvement. And so, like, if you actually have a job, like a responsibility at a company where you can have the ownership to solve a problem like that and not just push paperwork, that's when the career becomes fun. And I almost didn't make it to this point. I was literally in my years of auditing, I was like, similar thing with my fiance. Like, I hate this. Like, I don't want to do this. I can't do this for the rest of my life. And it just took one role, and I'm doing the same things. Like, I'm involved in, you know, so I have the expertise. It's like, I've learned all of this stuff that, did I want to learn it? No, but I did. And so I have it, but now I'm in a role where I can design, you know, like a solution around it and make it easier and think about it differently. And, dude, know, just the nature of compliance, like those frameworks are so hard to read. It's so boring to read. And like, it's really,
no one was like, really, Hey Jack, how do I get your job, man? No one ever said that, right?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. It seems for me, dude. You have to have a lot of creative outlets in those early years. I mean, like, I'm a musician. Like, I'm just a creative.
What do you play?
Guitar.
Dude.
First and foremost.
Yeah, buddy. Who's your favorite guitarist? Who's the most underrated guitar player? Let's talk about that now. Let's go.
All right. Underrated. Well, not underrated, but favorite guitar player is just your classic answer. I love Jimi Hendrix.
Okay. Okay. He was innovative for his time. Dude, we just had a conversation about Jimi Hendrix the other day. Okay. Like, I think, yeah. I mean, he was so innovative, right? So I'll give him that. You know who I think is, like, the most underrated guitar player of our time right now? I think John Mayer, man. He's underrated.
I don't think he's underrated John Mayer. I mean, I just went to my Dead & Co. show. But, like, you know, I don't think he's amazing. I don't think he's underrated.
He's amazing. Okay.
I think he's very well hyped. That show was unreal. And like, you go down to see Mayer. He's just,
dude. Oh my gosh, dude. Yeah. So how did you get into guitar, man? Yeah. So you're a little younger than me, but how did you get into it, man?
Dude, I got my first guitar when I was like 8. Just a classical guitar. I had a really sick guitar shop down the street from my house that was like, you know, just specialty acoustic guitars, like classical and like just Taylor guitars. And then they also offered lessons. So, I mean, I got in really young, took some lessons. I was like kind of about it, but didn't love the whole like lesson structure, like learning music, like at the time when you're 10. And like, I didn't have parents being, you need to learn music. Like, they didn't give a shit what I did. Like, they were like, we're stoked for your guitar.
Dude, and we're so the same.
Right. Kind of got like a little bit of an upbringing there, but I just really liked making my own songs. Like once I learned the chords, and then like a little bit later, I had a friend's dad who's just absolute chiller. Like he was like work from home guy, like well before work from home was like a thing. And he would just like give me guitar lessons out of his house. And instead of like learning, you know, like reading music, he would like teach me music theory based on like a reference song. So we'd play like a Pearl Jam song and learn like a technique of guitar, and he would like really cater the songs that we learned. We'd learn the whole thing through, even like the lead parts, because like, and he would pick songs that had like specific techniques that you can kind of, this is going to sound so corny, but in a way, like what I'm talking about, like requirements wise, it's kind of like the same thing with guitar. Is like you learn a technique and then you can like apply it to different places. And
I get you. I see you, Jack Rumsey. I see you, dude. I love it, man. You're like, yeah, that's amazing. So you've been playing since you were 8.
It wasn't even until here. I'd be like always doing this one lead technique. And then it would be like later in life, like, oh, I should probably like really learn what the pentatonic scale is here. And then I'd be like, oh, this actually fits into the pentatonic scale. This is that thing I always do. I just know it from like, you know, going 2 frets up and then hitting these strings and just doing that in specific keys. But I'm like, oh, that's actually just a pentatonic scale. I'm just doing a really sick kind of lead within it that I've always been doing. Like, I really love Lou Reed, like just from a sound perspective. Like I love the Velvet Underground. Like I like that really just like raw kind of ground out sound. So he's a big inspiration as well.
Sweet. So you play, that's awesome. What's your favorite guitar that you have right now?
I've got like a vintage LTD, like an ESP LTD right now that I
just picked up from
Guitar Center. And those are typically heavy metal guitars. And I'm like, I don't play like heavy metal or like crazy distortion, usually just like a lot of crunch, but it's an awesome sound guitar. But I mean, I grew up with, you know, your classics. Like I grew up with Epiphone Les Paul. And I had the guitar for 15 years and it was like the best thing that has ever happened to me. Like I still absolutely love Epiphone You know, I never was rich enough to get the Gibson. I love just like a nice classic Epiphone Les Paul. Those things shred.
You mentioned Guitar Center. I remember I was working at Adobe. I built the Common Controls with my friend at Adobe.
Dude, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. I stumbled upon that in this role, and I was like, who the fuck took the time to do this? I was like, this is awesome. And I'm like, yeah. I hear you on the talk. You're like, I actually did that. I was like, it makes sense that he started his own company. Like, this is someone who's thinking about solving these problems, like, well before everyone else. That was sort of revolutionary in its own way. That was the only resource I could ever find, like, a couple of years ago that would start to be solving some of these problems. So that's crazy that you had a hand in that.
Yeah, it was a project. I mean, I was one of the main architects, so, but a lot of smart people, you know, were behind that. I was just talking to two of them today, you know, but yeah, there are lots of great people. Like, so Prashant Vadlamudi, he's at Cisco right now, but he was one of the big ones. And so we're still kind of partners, right? And, you know, Rahat Sethi. Yeah, dude, you mentioned, so Guitar Center, I remember we were working on it. So we're talking like 2014, right? Or 20, yeah, it's like 2014. You know, we're kind of building all this stuff. And I was like, dude, I want my PRS. So I wanted a PRS Custom 24 forever. And I was like, I want one. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's the Black Sunburst. So the Black Sunburst PRS, like, you just look at the picture and it's like, oh man, there it is. And I was like, hey, I'm going to go like negotiate on it. And I went to a Santa. So I went online. I said, hey, can I negotiate on this price? Right. Like, can I negotiate? They're like, oh, dude, you have to be at the Guitar Center to do it. And I'm like, oh, where's the shop? Where is it? In San Jose. And I'm like, dude, I'm here right now. We're working on it. So I'm like, hey, guys, I'm going to Guitar Center right now. I'm going to go buy this thing. And so I went, and some high school kid, right, you know, is there. And I'm like, hey, can I get this? I think I paid, it was like $2,200. It's like a $7,000 guitar. I'm like, hey, can I buy this for $2,200? And he's like, and some high school kid, he's like, what's that commission? He's like, he's like yeah, so we got it. You know what I mean? It was so funny. But dude, it's like my favorite. I don't have any guitar envy ever, man. I love my guitar. Like, so I just love my, I have a custom 24. I had surgery a little bit ago, and so my hands aren't the same, but it's getting better, right? So yeah, man, you get old fast, man. It happens fast, right? So
that makes me think of another underrated guitar player. I can't think of his name, but it's the head guy for a band called Unknown Mortal Orchestra. It's an indie rock band, but the dude.
Okay. I've never heard. Okay. Never heard.
Like, if you just kind of like Google that band on YouTube, there's a lot of great content coming from this dude. I think his first name's Ruben. I could probably Google it in a second, but he was talking in this one interview how he's got this custom guitar that's like more forgiving on his hands because he's toured for so long that like he's got some neurological stuff going on with his hands. I was like, dude, I was always like stoked on guitar because it's something that I could have for life, because it's not, I'd never thought it was tied to anything physically. It's like, you know, when I stop being able to snowboard well or like do sports well, you know, do activities, I get older, I'm always gonna have guitar. And it's crazy to see, like, even the like guitar players like get crazy injuries from just simply playing that much.
Me and Tyler, when we were starting Paramify, I mean, I was coding right with him, right? I mean, when you're a founder, right, you do everything. And we were working so much. It was just me and Tyler. And dude, one day I was like, I can't feel my hand anymore. I left it. I can't. Right. I'm like, I can't feel my hand anymore. I'm like, what happened? Like, oh yeah, you have cubital tunnel and carpal tunnel. And yeah, so you're gonna have to get surgery. And so I had to get it was awful. And so it's about 85-90% now. But like, I think that's
like the tagline of your brand. Just be like, I have the most grit in GRC. Like, I literally got carpal tunnel because I've been coding this shit so hard.
Oh dude, no one cares, man. They just care about knowing Jeremy, oh, man, they just, yeah. No, you know what? I do want to, I mean, dude, Jack, I think you feel it too, right? You feel like you did this job and there's a reason you did it. And to me, it's like to free the captives, man. There's, because GRC people, like, you offer a lot of value, right? IT auditors, right? There's so much value that they have, and it gets lost in the paper chase, man. It gets hidden behind all this compliance BS, right? So it's like, dude, we need people like you, you know, to step up, right, and to really carry this forward so that we can, you know, so that we can get to a place where we're managing security and a little bit better, because to this point, we're really behind, right? And so, anyways, Jack, dude, I'm glad I have a new friend, right? This is awesome. Let's do it again. And man, dude, Godspeed. We're excited for what you guys are doing at Swimlane. And man, this has been great, dude. Thanks for coming on the show, brother.
Yeah, likewise, Kenny. Have me on anytime. I can chat about this stuff all day. So thanks for having me on. It was awesome.
All right, brother.